Uploading the virus.
Eagle One, the package is being delivered.
Hello out there in cyberspace. You know, there are a lot of companies out there willing to sell shady customers the tools they need to spy on just about anyone. All over the world, software vendors like Hacking Team and NSO Group will help you break into a cell phone and read email you're not supposed to. That might soon be changing. I'm going to close Slack so you don't have to hear those messages. That might soon be changing. With us today to talk about this and more is Motherboard senior staff writer Lorenzo Franceschi Bicarai. It's the subject of his new piece on the site, The U.S. Crackdown on Spyware Vendors is Only Beginning. Lorenzo, it's a day. How are you?
I'm okay, all things considered, and I'm glad to be back on the show.
Excellent. People are telling me in chat, can you guys hear me? Are we muted? Okay, I think we're okay. Thank you for, yeah. You're getting sound shadow? I don't know what sound shadow is.
Sounds cool, though.
It does sound cool. Okay, they can hear us. Okay, perfect. So sorry about that. All right, so let's talk about this piece. This the U.S. crackdown on spyware vendors is only beginning. What exactly happened earlier this week, Lorenzo?
Apologies. So last week, the Department of Justice in California indicted a Mexican citizen, or rather announced the settlement of an indicted citizen, a Mexican citizen, who admitted to having conspired to wiretap and sell wiretapping and surveillance devices to the government of Mexico. The reason why the US DOJ is involved in this case is because, as part of his activities as a reseller of surveillance technology, the citizen, who's named Carlos Guerrero, also spied on a company in Florida. And the U.S. accused them of helping, like, for example, they cited a few examples of potential crimes. One of them was that he helped a mayor in Mexico to spy on a political opponent using software made by a Hacking Team. For those of you who don't remember, Hacking Team was a spyware company based in Milan, Italy, that sold computer spyware and later mobile spyware to governments around the world. For a while, it was the biggest company selling this. They had, like, I think around almost 40 customers around the world, anywhere from Southeast Asia to Latin America, Europe. They even sold to the DEA at some point. The reason why this case is very interesting is because until now, we hadn't seen the DOJ go after resellers. These are people like this Carlos Guerrero in question here. They are companies that helped other companies like Hacking Team make deals in Mexico and other places. NSO, which is a competitor of Hacking Team, which is now the mark, you know, the industry leader in the surveillance spyware world, also has used the resellers around the world. So it's an open question now. What's going to happen to these resellers? Should they avoid going to Miami on vacation? That's probably, I would say, but I get it. It's nice Cuban food. So maybe they will want to do that.
Can you explain a little bit about how this software actually works and functions? Like, have you ever seen its UI and like how exactly does it work?
Yeah. So this is pretty standard, or was, you know, Hacking Team was disbanded a couple of years ago, or rather was acquired and then rebranded. What they used to make was, initially, it was a computer spyware. So it was a software that would get installed surreptitiously on a target's computer and would allow its users, who are government agents, government employees, to spy on the target computer. So they would be able to intercept emails, monitor social media activity, you know, even turn on the webcam, turn on the microphone, record conversations. Later on, Hacking Team also developed mobile spyware with the same capabilities. They would be able to hack into phones, turn on the microphone, intercept messages and calls, all these kind of things that, you know, cops or spies may be interested in. And yeah, I just wanted to say that, like, this has become like a pretty big industry, you know, multi-billion dollar industry. There's companies everywhere. As I mentioned, NSO is probably the leader right now, although as we've spoken in previous shows, they're not doing super well right now. But yeah, there was FinFisher, or there still is FinFisher, a German company, and many, many competitors around the world.
Yeah, this was another one of my big questions, is who exactly are the clients here? Who is buying this stuff?
So companies like Hacking Team or NSO are exclusively marketing to governments. So they do not sell to, you know, private individuals or businesses. They only sell to government organizations. So, for example, Hacking Team used to sell to a bunch of Mexican local authorities, state law enforcements. They sold to the DEA in the U.S. The FBI for a while tested it as well. So we're talking about basically any law enforcement or intelligence agency in the world. Hacking Team used to say that they wouldn't sell to repressive governments. That was not totally true. And also it depended on your definition of repressive governments. NSO has made the same claims, but, you know, as part, some of their customers have been revealed to be the likes of Saudi Arabia, the UAE, you know, governments that are not exactly democratic or have a good track record of they have a good track record of repressive policies.
All right. So what laws were actually violated here? What was he arrested for?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is interesting because, you know, on the face of it, this does not appear to be a case that the DOJ, that the US DOJ should have gone after. You know, we're talking about a Mexican citizen with who founded a Mexican company that was the one that worked with Hacking Team and the Mexican government customers. But the DOJ has made the case that this was in under their jurisdiction because in one of the cases of abuse that they cite in the settlement, the mayor of a Mexican state, the mayor of a Mexican city hacked someone and they hacked their Hotmail and Gmail account. So the argument here is, you know, these are US companies with US servers. So if someone hacks someone using these companies, then it is a crime in the US. There was also another case where Guerrero and some of his employees intercepted communications from a Florida-based business, which is a more clear example of, you know, a wiretapping crime in the U.S. So, yeah, the charges were illegal wiretapping and conspiracy to wiretap.
So this is interesting that cyber stuff has made the jurisdiction of these things very interesting. And would you kind of say that this is a... maybe test case is the wrong word, but this is a sign of things to come, I guess.
I think it may very well be a sign of things to come, and that's not really just my opinion. In the press release when the DOJ announced this, the U.S. Attorney Randy Grossman was quoted as saying, and I quote, "Today's guilty plea helps stem the proliferation of digital tools used for oppression and advances the digital security of both U.S. and Mexican citizens." And essentially the DOJ made a point here that they are going to go after companies like this. They're going to go after people like Guerrero. You know, this is not just a Mexican problem. The US DOJ clearly sees this as something that can hurt the US national security. And so they're going to go after it in many ways. And recently we've seen, before this case, we've seen, for example, the U.S. government announce sanctions against the NSO, or rather they added NSO to a block list that prevents U.S. companies from selling software to NSO. So we're seeing really a multi-pronged approach to clamping down on this industry.
For people that don't have the background, can you tell us a little bit about the NSO group, who they are, and what kind of stuff that they sell?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, NSO Group is a Israeli-based company. They are around 10 years old at this point. They are like Hacking Team, a vendor which specializes in making and selling surveillance tools and hacking tools. In their case, they specialize in mobile surveillance. So they're very well known for making iPhone and Android hacking tools. They sell them to governments. They're a pretty large company. Reports say that they are around 600 people, you know, compared to Hacking Team, for example. Hacking Team was like 40, 45 people. So they're a pretty big company, and they have been in the news a lot last year after a coalition of newspapers and media outlets published a bunch of stories detailing alleged abuses by their customers. Abuses all over the world: Hungary, Mexico, Saudi Arabia, and they're really under a lot of pressure right now because of this sanction by the US government, because of all the scandals. Their investors are getting a little antsy, and it's really unclear what's going to happen to them. But I think it's important to stress that the industry is not going anywhere. You know, we're not going to move to a world in which the police does not need to monitor a terrorist or a criminal's phone or computer. If anything, they're going to need that more and more. So even if NSO were to disappear, which is very much an open question, and, you know, I don't know if that's going to happen, somebody else will step in.
Well, and it also strikes me that this is stuff that we know to a certain degree the U.S. government is doing too, right? I mean, we may not have all the details, but we do know. I mean, there was a story not too recently about the CIA's information gathering stuff. So do you think, maybe this is too speculative a question, but do you think it's a little bit hypocritical for us to go after private, for the U.S. government to go after private companies that are doing some of the same stuff that it's doing?
I think it's a good question. And that is something that could be argued, right? Like, as I said, this kind of industry is not going to go anywhere. It exists in the US as well. There's an interesting trend in the market, though, that I think it's important to remember. The US government is very, is not very happy usually to make deals with foreign companies on such, you know, on such sensitive operations like spying on someone. Although, as I said, like the DEA had a contract with the Hacking Team. Some local police departments considered buying NSO. So, you know, it's not unprecedented. But when you talk about intelligence agencies like the NSA, they do prefer local vendors. So, yeah, you could argue that, you know, the U.S. is doing this as well. There's U.S. companies doing this. But I guess what the U.S. government is arguing is that as opposed to what happens in the U.S., companies like Hacking Team and NSO are acting in a less regulated market. They're working with governments that are, you know, have questionable human rights records. And that's why they deserve more attention.
All right. We're going to pause there just very briefly for a break. We will be right back after just a brief moment of silence, and then we're going to do a cipher. Are you going to stick around with me, Lorenzo?
I will.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
All right. Thank you for sticking around. All right, Lorenzo. So welcome back to Cyber. And now it's time for Cypher. It's that part of the show where we decipher the week's biggest tech stories. So if you're watching this live, you know what day it is. You know what's going on in the news. If you're listening to this later, we're recording this on February 24th. It is just shy of 4 p.m. on the East Coast. Russia has invaded Ukraine. The newsroom has been a busy place today. You know, I think this particular episode of Cyber feels a little rough and ragged around the edges because we've been extremely busy. You and I have both been talking to people and getting stories out and just, yeah, I mean, chat, like, like as soon as we start talking about it, chat is kind of comes alive. I feel like this is the big story right now. This is what everyone's talking about and what everyone wants to know about. I want to ask you like a big picture question, first of all, because you're not, you're, you know, of European extraction. And I think that American perspectives on this, in my opinion, have been a little weird in the lead up to it. How are you feeling about all of this? You know, what do you see big picture?
Well, I think there's a lot of concern in Europe because, you know, this is a war on the European Union's doors or, you know, at its borders, Ukraine borders with Slovakia and Romania and Poland. So, you know, this is really happening in the backyard of the European Union's. So I think there's a lot of nervousness, a lot of unease. I was talking to someone, like a friend last week, and they were talking about, like, going to the countryside for a little bit just in case. They're nowhere close to Ukraine. You know, I personally think that that's maybe a little bit premature, but we really don't know what's going to happen, right? This is the very first, or this is like the biggest war in Europe since World War II. So there's a lot of uncertainty and a lot of nervousness for sure.
I think we keep saying that. I want to push back against it being the biggest land war in Europe since World War II. I think we forget the 90s and right. The Balkans,
that's true.
Right? Like there's this whole war that I would say, I think, established the way the US and the EU or NATO, looked at the way, like thought of itself and what it could do and what its power could be used for. And then got us into a lot of trouble over the next 20 years. And we forget that war for some reason. But let's get into some of the stories that you and I have been working on, cyber war, basically. So the first one I think that was really interesting today, from you is that the Russian government websites are currently down. Are they still down? And what happened? Do we know what happened?
So we don't know what happened, and I'm actually just checking live if the Kremlin's website is still down. It was like an hour ago. But so just to set the stage, obviously, the lead up to this war, this invasion was relatively long. You know, people have been talking about this happening for weeks. And we have seen some activity in the cyberspace, for lack of a better word. There have been a bunch of distributed denial of service attacks. Those are attacks that essentially flood target websites with traffic, forcing them to go down, you know, making them inaccessible. It happened like 10 days ago with some Ukrainian government websites and some large Ukrainian banks. The Ukrainian government was quick to accuse Russia of doing that. And the U.S. government also surprisingly came out just a couple of days later, also attributing those attacks to Russia. So, and the other important piece of context that we should mention here is that yesterday, some cybersecurity companies, namely ESET and Symantec, found some malware on Ukrainian systems. This was destructive malware called, you know, wipe. It's a type of malware known as a wiper malware, because it wipes machines and makes them unusable. It's unclear who that was, but, you know, this is all to say that there's been a lot of activity in Ukraine and around Ukraine in terms of cybersecurity, and a lot of speculation about what cyber, you know, what cyber warfare, if you want to call it that way, what role that would play in this conflict. You know, obviously, once the tanks start rolling in and bombs start falling down, anything related to cybersecurity is not as important anymore. But it can have an important role in terms of surveillance, in terms of collecting intelligence, and maybe even stuff like taking down power grids, which Russia has done in the past in Ukraine. So what happened today is that a few Russian government websites were inaccessible for a bit. One of them was the Kremlin's official website, which I just checked, it's back up. It's really unclear what happened. Some people were speculating that they were sort of geofencing it, meaning that Russia was making it unavailable to foreign visitors, but we couldn't really confirm that because even with a Russian VPN, we could not access it. You know, it could be anything from an outage or maybe a DDoS attack launched by God knows who. You know, could be the Ukrainian government, but could also just be a bunch of kids, like this has happened in the past. But yeah, it's interesting because there's a lot of speculation about what, you know, what these the two parties in this war could do in cyberspace.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I want to throw some things from chat into the conversation. I just tried to access it. Also, I couldn't get into the basic websites. Several people in chat have said that it's been down for them for many hours. One thing I think I think is interesting here, I'm going to call Loompa. Let's not forget that Russia has been planning on this for a long period. They are most likely also very prepared cyber-wise. I think that's a very good point. I would also point out that Russia has been doing this for a long time. They have kind of a playbook with cyber. I first remember hearing about in 2008 when they invaded Georgia. It was the first time I remember Georgians like reporting of these mass outages, power outages, internet outages, sites being inaccessible ahead of the invasion. So we've seen this playbook before, right? I don't remember Russian websites ever going down, and I could be wrong. Again, there's lots of information out there, and this feels different. This whole war feels different than previous conflicts involving Russia from the past 15 years or so. So we'll see. The other thing I think is really interesting, and I want to get your thoughts on this. Again, we're going to speculate a little bit. People are asking what possible U.S. cyber involvement might look like, and if that occurs, how attributable might it be, and would that be considered, you know, do you think that something like a cyber attack rises to the level of being considered traditional conflict or traditional war? Is that something that you might see real world reprisals from later? I would argue that we're sussing all of that out right now. Like all of the standards around that stuff are being established in the moment. But what are your thoughts, Lorenzo?
Yeah, I think that's the short answer. There aren't really a lot of written rules over this. There's been a lot of you know, academic discussions about the around this. Think tanks chiming in the past. Cybersecurity experts saying that yeah, this should be considered war. Others say don't be ridiculous. It's just the ones and zeros. So yeah, the answer to like is this, you know, could like a cyber attack lead to kinetic response? It's unclear. I guess it depends, right? You know, something like Stuxnet did have real life implications. You know, I'm talking about the malware that US and Israel planted on Iranians' nuclear facilities that slowed down the enrichment of uranium and, like, you know, crippled Iran's nuclear development. You know, something like that could be considered an act of war. It's, you know, some people would call that a sabotage. You know, taking out the electrical grid in Moscow, is that an act of war? I don't know. I think it's, I think, as you said, it's an act of war if the victim considers it an act of war, right? Yeah. If whoever gets hacked considers that an act of war and they retaliate, then yes, it will be an act of war. But, you know, there isn't really a playbook here that we can go back to. In terms of the first question, which was, what's the U.S. role or what could it be? You know, we're all speculating here. It's unclear what the U.S. wants to do other than, you know, imposing sanctions, which has happened in the past few days and has happened again today. Again, it's speculative, but, you know, the U.S. is the biggest power in the world, not just militarily, but also in cyberspace. So they could do anything from, you know, taking down the internet in portions of Russia, intercepting communications on the ground, you know, to collect intelligence and pass it on to the Ukraine. You know, they could do a lot, and they may be preparing to do that. And, you know, those are all things that have been done before. I think during the, there were reports during the last election in 2020 that the US took down the internet from some Russian government agencies that were like, working on disinformation campaigns. So, you know, there are precedents for this, and they may very well not be considered acts of war, but just, you know, regular espionage and cyber shenanigans.
Yeah, it's hard to say. It's hard to say how anyone's going to react to that stuff. I think, judging on what we've already seen of Biden, I think he's being especially cautious, right? I mean, I think the sanctions are perhaps not going as far as some people would like, right? And he has repeatedly said that there will be no American troops fighting in Ukraine. It wouldn't surprise me, with his age and his understanding of the internet, that he would maybe consider it a traditional act of war and he would hold off. But again, we're just speculating. We don't know. Let's talk about something we do know about. So this, I wrote this story today that I think you found interesting, Lorenzo, right?
I thought that this was a very good example of how much the internet allows anyone to follow a geopolitical event like this. I'm talking about the story with the headline, Google Maps live track traffic showed the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Can you walk us through what happened here, Matt?
Yeah, I'm throwing it to chat so they can get up to speed with the story as I've got it pulled up here. So basically what happened is at 3:15 a.m. In Ukraine, Jeffrey Lewis, who's a guy that I've used as a source on a lot of different stories. He's traditionally in the nuclear world. He uses a lot of open source intelligence to suss out what is going on with China building new ICBM facilities and stuff in Iran and like spinning up the enriched uranium and like that kind of thing. He noticed on Google Maps that there was a traffic jam on a road from on the Ukrainian border, and this was about 45 minutes before the invasion started in full. And he kind of realized that there's this big traffic jam, and he's like, "Oh shit, the invasion is actually about to start." Now, what we didn't know at the time, and he told me this morning. When I talked to him, because he had extra information that he did not share with the public, which was good ethics of open source intelligence. They had satellite imagery that they had pulled off of a public satellite 24 hours before that showed like a mass movement of Russian armor and troops right into that region. So then knowing that and having that picture and then seeing like the traffic basically get stopped on that road where they saw all that armor, he was like, "Oh, I'm one of the first people to know that the invasion is about to happen. And it's happening because traffic patterns on Google Maps," which is just completely wild. Like, what kind of world do we live in, right? Where we know Google Maps is the first thing to tell us that a war is about to happen, right? If you have the other pieces of information. We all looked at the picture and we're like, "Oh shit, it's coming," he said. So it's the prior work of knowing that there's a giant Russian armored unit sitting right there that allowed us to say like, "Oh, I know that this is a traffic jam. They're getting on the road." The other thing I thought he said that was really interesting, is that, we live in this world where all of these companies are hoovering up data and making it of use to us, and they make our lives comfortable. But when we get into these confrontations where the data could be used in insidious ways, right? We have this, like, did we need to know this? Was this a good thing to be putting out? But also, how does Google shut it down? Does Google turn off all the traffic data in Ukraine for the duration? Well, that could hurt people trying to flee, right? It's a hard question to ask. It's really strange. And he said, "I think big data companies often don't want to face squarely how useful their data can be. I mean, it's cool when we do it, right? It's maybe less cool if Russians were able to do something similar to, you know, spotting an offense from Ukrainians." And this goes into a conversation I had yesterday with Jason about like the ethics of open source intelligence stuff. There's a lot of people that are getting into this field and are like, they're amateurs, like learning how to suss out what's real and what's not on social media, following this war specifically. And I would just caution people to be very, very careful and to like triple confirm things before they put anything out there. Because one, like literally before, right before I logged onto the call, I was seeing footage that was being attributed as like anti-aircraft fire on a Russian jet. Well, it was an A-10 Warthog that was being fired on, which is a plane that I know that Russia doesn't have. And if you looked a little bit closer, it was footage from a video game. It was Arma footage that someone had put up and said was from, you know, the front lines. So, like, that kind of stuff is everywhere now. Everywhere right now. And the other thing that we have to be careful about, as Lewis said, is that this is life and death stuff. This is life and death for people. And if you figure out using satellite imagery or Google Maps or whatever else, what troop movements might be, don't share it. Don't put that out there because it's information that could get people killed, you know? And there's so many ways. Like I was listening last night to a UHF band of the fighters, the Russian fighter pilots. Like you can, it's easy now if you kind of know what to do to like listen in on that stuff and get that information. But you have to be careful about what you amplify and what you share, and is it worth it? And often it isn't. So I just want to have that word of caution as we go forward.
Yeah, as you said, I think it's important to remember that a lot of stuff on Twitter may not be true. You know, there's just a lot of, first of all, there's a lot of actually coordinated professional disinformation and misinformation going on. You know, companies and governments that put out stuff with the intent of confusing people, with the intent of deceiving people. So the public really needs to be careful what they amplify. And it's not just governments and companies. It's also just trolls that like to make, you know, embarrass people who just want to go viral with their OSINT.
There's been a lot less shit posting at the beginning, but I like the first 12 hours or so, I think people were really shocked. But I am seeing that side of it, like the irony poisoned people starting to kind of ramp up and put really bizarre things out there. So I'm sure that'll get worse as time wears on. So speaking of sanctions and reprisals, Zelensky kind of did this step by step list of things that he would like to see happen to Russia, right? And one of those things was making it harder for. What exactly was this? Because this is a story that you wrote, Lorenzo. Would banning Russia from getting software updates make it easier to hack? I'll throw it into the chat, and you can tell me about what's going on.
Yeah, so this story started when Rafael Satter from Reuters posted a larger version of that list. So there's a public list of sort of, you know, reprisals that the Ukrainian government was asking the U.S. to do, sort of like suggested actions to respond to the invasion. And Rafael got a hold of a longer list that Ukrainian diplomats sent him. And the list included a lot of things. The thing that really caught my attention was a call for a ban on software updates to Russia, not just Russian government, Russian citizens. So Ukraine was basically arguing, you know, cut off Russia from getting patches on, you know, I don't know, Windows, iOS, whatever, any kind of software they're using. And the idea, you know, it's not spelled out in the document, but the idea is to make life harder, you know, for Russians, make it harder to use any kind of software. And also, theoretically, it could make them more vulnerable to cybersecurity attacks, because if you're not able to update your software, if you're not able to apply security patches, then you are vulnerable to simpler and easier to pull off attacks. It's unclear if the US is going to do this. It's also unclear how you would be able to do it. I spoke to some experts who were intrigued by this idea. You know, it's not impossible. The US does have similar sanctions in place for countries like Iran or North Korea or Cuba. So it could be done, but you know the repercussions for doing that are unclear. There's U.S. companies in Russia. You know, could they be kicked out at that point? Would their employees face any reprisals? Yeah, it's uncharted territory.
Do you think it would work? Like, meaning, would it make them easier to hack if you couldn't update to Windows 11?
I think in theory, yes. There has been a movement inside the Russian government for the last 10 years to move to open source software rather than closed source proprietary software. But I don't know how successful it has been. You know, I'm not sure if like the GRU runs on Linux or Ubuntu. You know, that would kind of surprise me. In theory, it would be, you could do some damage by limiting their updates. I just don't know how you do that in practice. Like, do you just prevent Microsoft from sending updates to any Russian IP? Is there any way to get around that for Russia? It just sounds like a very hard thing to implement, and also with limited impact, especially now that the war has moved to the real world with people getting killed and people fighting on the ground.
Right. And I also think that it would create, it's not like people can't pirate security updates, right? And it's not like that kind of stuff isn't ubiquitous all over the rest of the world. So yeah, it would be incredibly hard. And the internet's so diffuse, it would be incredibly hard to like put together.
Yeah, and it may hurt more like regular citizens than government agencies. So like, what is the impact there?
I want to address this question that just came in chat. What's your theory? What will be up next after Russia has fully conquered Ukraine? Do you believe he's craving to be the greatest? B, in the history books, will he forcibly reunite the Slavic countries? I think beware of anyone that tells you they know what's going to happen or has a good theory about what's going to happen. We spent the last 10 years, we spent the last couple of weeks and months, lots of people making predictions about what was going to happen. And the only person that really knew what was going to happen was Putin. And we're journalists, so we speculate a little bit, but we try to be very, very careful about what we put out there. Or at least I do. I think Lorenzo, you do too. And I see so many journalists making predictions and falling flat on their face and being wrong, being incredibly wrong, especially in the lead up to this. So I don't like to do it. I think you just watch the information as it comes out and kind of make your own judgments about what you think is going to happen. I think watch Moldova, watch Belarus, and just be careful about what you trust online right now. And I think that's going to wrap it up for this second cyber. Lorenzo, where can people find your work?
They can find me at Lorenzo FB on Twitter.
And I'm at MJ Galt on Twitter. I'm going to be writing about this kind of stuff for the foreseeable future. We will be back next week with two more episodes of Cyber. If you missed the beginning of this episode, it's going to be uploaded as a podcast very soon. Please follow us on here, you'll get updates whenever we go live, typically shooting for like 4 p.m. on a Wednesday, but things are a little chaotic right now, so they're going to kind of come as they come, and I'm sure we'll be again talking about Ukraine more in the future. Thank everyone for coming by. Thanks for joining the chat, and we will stay safe. We will talk to you again soon. Bye.
Bye, everyone.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.